Welcome to Aging in Place, a podcast about the challenges of home and community-based living for seniors and people living with disabilities, and discussing the tools and solutions available to residents of the state of Washington.
In this episode of Aging in Place, we are interviewing Bea Rector, who is the Assistant Secretary of Aging and Long-Term Support Administration, also known as ALTSA. ALTSA is one of the administrations which comprise the Department of Social and Health Services, whose mission statement is to transform lives. Thanks for joining us, Bea.
Thank you, Julie.
Would you please describe the role of Aging and Long-Term Support Administration within DSHS, and in your words, its role and responsibilities for Washington citizens or Washingtonians?
Sure. So Aging and Long-Term Support Administration is one of five service administrations within the larger Department of Social and Health Services. Department of Social and Health Services has 17,000 employees and really is a human service, social service kind of umbrella agency, the largest agency in state government, delivering kind of safety net services to Washingtonians. Aging and Long-Term Support Administration, as you said, our mission is to transform lives. And we do that in our administration by promoting choice, independence, and safety through innovative services. And we really want to make sure that seniors and people with disabilities are living in good health, independence, dignity, and control over the decisions that affect their daily lives. We are an operating agency under the state Medicaid agency, the Healthcare Authority, and Home and Community Services Division is really kind of the service arm of Medicaid. They do things like determining eligibility, assessment, service planning, and case management, also housing, employment, and care coordination, oversee and contract with the state's 13 area agencies on aging, which are functions of the federal Older Americans Act. And then Home and Community Services also has a really strong emphasis on supporting informal caregivers, people with disabilities, people that are older adults, but also children through our Kinship Caregivers Program. So we have Adult Protective Services also. Adult Protective Services educates the public around adult and elder abuse awareness. They investigate allegations of abuse, neglect, and exploitation, self-neglect, financial exploitation, and they also provide protective services and operate the state's Adult Protective Services Registry, which means that individuals that have substantiated cases of abuse, neglect, and exploitation will not be allowed to work with vulnerable children or vulnerable adults. We have Residential Care Services that regulates the state's licensed and certified long-term care settings. Those include nursing homes, residential rehabilitation centers, adult family homes, assisted living, and enhanced services facilities, as well as supported living providers for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So Residential Care Services licenses, they do complaint investigation, and their role really is to make sure that provider practice is consistent with our state statutes and rules, and we regulate about 5,000 providers across the state of Washington. We also have the Office of Deaf and Hard of Hearing, a small division, but a critical division as they provide communication and access supports to individuals who are deaf, deafblind, or hard of hearing. We know that particularly being hard of hearing has significant impacts for people's ability to stay engaged in their family life, in their community life, also has ties to Alzheimer's and dementia, if not addressed, and leads to a lot of social isolation. So that small but mighty division is critically important as more and more people age, and often aging comes with being hard of hearing, or that becomes something over time. We also have our Management Services Division. They're really the backbone of our enterprise. They ensure that our staff, our providers, our clients have good contracts. They get paid for the services, that we have our budgeting processes and our facilities for our staff. And then we have our Office of Assistant Secretary. We really provide support, partnership, and leadership for many elements of that work across all of those divisions. Things like strategic planning, legislative relations, communications, our relationships in our government to government with our tribal governments, quality assurance, all of our employee engagement and leadership development and training, audits, public disclosure, emergency management, which we learned how important that was during the pandemic.
Indeed.
As well as EDAI. So together, those divisions all work to make sure that we're able to achieve our mission and our vision as an organization.
Thank you. So tell us how your professional experience with long-term services and supports prepared you as Alta's Assistant Secretary. And how has your experience informed your leadership within this public administration?
So when I was working on my Master of Public Administration at the University of Washington, I was working at a temporary agency that was responsible for helping businesses get temp employees. And I saw a job opening at Catholic Community Services. And I had gotten some feedback from my supervisor at the temp agency that when it comes right down to it and you're negotiating a price to the business and you're negotiating a wage to the temporary worker that we're sending out, you will always give the penny, not to our business, but to the employee. And that was said kind of as a criticism. And I was thinking about that and thinking, I'm going for my public administration degree. I was focused on nonprofit management. And here I was working in a for-profit organization that really saw profits as the most important thing. So at that point, I saw this job opening at Catholic Community Services. It was a nonprofit. It was actually a human resources position that would be responsible for recruiting caregivers for their home care program. And so I applied for it and ended up working 10 years at Catholic Community Services. And that gave me a real on-the-ground experience about the workforce.
Yes.
The importance of the workforce, who they are, kind of what motivates them to do the work. But I also got an opportunity to go out and visit clients in their own home to see what they needed, to see what their desires were. And really, it was kind of the ground floor, the very beginning of pulling down Medicaid money to be able to serve people in their own homes. And I do remember the very first referral that we got, where somebody was not going to be able to get out of bed unless we had a worker there to help them. And they were not going to be able to get out of their wheelchair at night to get back into bed unless we had somebody to help them. And we were worried about that. We were worried about the responsibility and could we actually get it done? And we did. And in fact, that became much more of the norm of the client than the person who just needed a little bit of help grocery shopping and a little bit of help cooking, which is kind of where it started. I left that job after having two children, and we had a 24/7 live-in business at Catholic Community Services, and I happened to be the second person who would get the call when somebody didn't show up.
I see.
And having two young children and getting calls in the middle of the night that a home care worker didn't show up for a client who needed 24/7, I was like, oh boy, I maybe need to change jobs while my kids are young. And a position came open at the state doing home care policy. And so I applied for that. It was at Aging and Long-Term Support Administration, which was known as Aging and Adult Services Administration at the time. And ended up getting that job. And so that was my first job at ALSA. But I was able to really apply that on-the-ground home care experience with direct care workers and clients to help inform policy. I think coming to the state government and working in that particular job, I worked a lot with area agencies on aging. I worked a lot with home care agencies and started to better understand what it takes to partner effectively with your provider network to cover the state in terms of policies. I also had the opportunity to work in the legislative environment around a home care agency parity bill, which we still have on the books today. And it really helps drive money into the home care agency budgets directed specifically to direct care workers. also in that job, the importance of partnering with area agencies on aging, the importance of government to government relationships, because we have two tribal area agencies on aging. And in that job, one of my first tasks was to create a quality assurance framework for case management at area agencies on aging. A law had passed really directing the state unit on aging to begin to do more in terms of quality oversight of case management.
When was that exactly? Do you recall?
That was in 1999.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That was in 1999. So we did a lot of that oversight and case management, which led to, you know, what kind of training do we need to develop? What kind of policies need to change as a result of what we were seeing or not seeing in the case management system? So, I mean, I think all of the jobs that I've had have helped to really hone the importance of the people who do the work. Certainly in a later job, I ended up getting assigned to the development of the CARE tool. And, and the job that I was assigned was put together the in-home algorithm that will determine what the benefit levels are for clients. And there were three of us working that, myself, Pat Drelo, and John Ely. And we were given a timeline. And at the time, we thought, no possible way can that be done. But what I learned from that was just the heterogeneity, I guess I would say, of the population served in in-home. There's nothing homogeneous about home and community-based services, right?
Right.
We serve people 18 to end of life, which is in the hundreds oftentimes. Right. The numbers of diagnoses, the variety of the types of activities of daily living and levels and severity of need differs dramatically person to person to person. And how
informal supports, right? That looks different for every individual.
Absolutely. And so being able to create something that was equitable, that treated two people who might have similar needs in two different parts of the state the same way, was really the criticisms that we were addressing when we were developing the CARE tool. And that was a real lessons learned on implementing a massive policy that impacted every single person that was served, some to the better, and some actually resulted in reduced benefits, and the impact of that from an administrative hearing perspective and a legal perspective and all of those kinds of things, a real learning experience for sure.
And for those who are not familiar, the CARE tool is the functional assessment that home and community services and our area agencies on aging use when meeting with clients, creating a care plan, and this identifies, as you mentioned earlier, the level of services or classification, if you will, of what individuals might be eligible for in home and community-based settings. So thank you for that. What do you feel are ALTA's greatest innovations in supporting aging and disabled adults here in Washington?
Well, I mean, I think our greatest innovations are that we are very intentional and tenacious in our mission. So if you look at that, what you need to know is what are the needs of the people that you're serving and how are those changing over time? And then you need to create the innovations that address the barriers, the gaps, the challenges in meeting that mission, which for us, of course, is people living in their setting of choice. And so we have been really innovative and successful in how we work in our authorizing environment with the governor's office, with the legislature, to change the laws and to make the appropriations necessary to actually move people from, you know, an over-reliance on institutionalization to truly being able to live in their own home. Supporting caregivers has been one of our best innovations, both from the perspective of being willing to pay family members to provide care and to see those family members as key to our provider network and our ability to serve individuals in rural areas, serve individuals with linguistic or cultural needs, and also supporting unpaid family caregivers, which really are the backbone of the long-term care system, providing probably at least 85% of all services in the nation and in Washington. Yeah. And having that choice, even for caregivers, in terms of do they want to provide services in an informal capacity or do they need to be paid for the work that they're doing? And if so, can they be qualified as a paid provider? I think that, again, under kind of just that sense of continual innovation, it's diverting and delaying. So delaying and diverting people from needing to go into institutional care, delaying and diverting individuals from coming on to more intensive or expensive services, delaying and diverting individuals from spending down their own resources and entering poverty as a way of having to access services. So a lot of that is, how do you help people maintain themselves, sustain themselves where they want to be? And then how do you design a system that's able to be that safety net in the event that people need that assistance? And that's what Medicaid really is that safety net service. I also think that being cost effective, we typically are seen as a national leader in the AARP scorecard that looks at states, we're usually up in the 1 or 2 range. But if you look at our costs, we are down in the 30s. So we have developed a high performing system, but we've also kept our eye on cost effectiveness. And I think that the innovation there is you could choose to spend a lot on a few people, or you could choose to serve as many people as you possibly can in a cost-effective way that's sustainable. And that's really been where our focus has been, is how do you create cost-effective services that do promote that choice and ability for people to access service when they need to, how they want to. And I think that that's probably our best innovation.
I think it's also important to note, too, that Washington is pretty tenacious, as you said earlier, in accessing funding opportunities. So maximizing state plan or using all of the waivers at our disposal and projecting and looking forward so that Washington is not maintaining a wait list for service accessibility. That can't be said for all states, right? Not all states operate and have as many state plans or waiver programs as we have. And if they do, there is often a wait list in thousands in some cases, or the tens of thousands. So that's something to be pretty proud of as well, as in the scheme of national long-term service and support delivery as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, we created an entitlement all the way back in, I think it was 1989, when we started our MPC state plan service, which put personal care as an entitlement in the state plan. So we actually have had an entitlement to personal care for decades, which is unusual. And you're right, we leverage funding. So we test things in discretionary funding, whether that be a general fund state, whether it's going after a grant, whether it's under the Older Americans Act. And then when we find something that really works for Washingtonians, we try to expand that reach of the pilot. And oftentimes that's by leveraging Medicaid funding.
What are your thoughts on the current strategies employed to improve outreach and to increase the diversity of the service providers who are supporting our BIPOC communities?
Going back to just the diversity of the individuals that access our services, there's over 70 languages spoken among the people who access Medicaid-funded long-term services and supports. A growing number of individuals represent BIPOC communities that are accessing our services. And we expect that to continue going into the next decades, because Washington is going to get more and more diverse. Family caregivers has been a big part of making sure that people can be served by somebody that is trusted, that is known, that speaks their language. When we created our home care aide certification in our state, which was passed by voter initiative in, I think, 2010, one of the things that that introduced is, how do you support a workforce that is that linguistically diverse? Every other healthcare certification requires people to train and test in English, but the home care certification is actually trained in 12 languages and tested in 12 languages. So one way of making sure that we are able to have people enter who may not speak English as their first language or may not speak English at all, that we train and we test in that number of languages. I think that that's certainly important. Home and community-based services is made up of a lot of small mom and pop providers, right? And that becomes critically important, whether it's serving a particular rural or geographic area, whether it's serving a tribal government community, whether it's serving a particularly ethnic population or linguistically unique population. I think one of the things that is critically important is that you continue to allow small businesses to enter the market, and they do tend to serve more of a BIPOC population. Our adult family homes are a good example of that. You know, we have moved from 3,000 adult family homes to 4,000 adult Right. family homes in the recent years. And a lot of that is small BIPOC owners coming into the business. You know, I think that part of our strategy in building a provider network that is diverse is partnering with our area agencies on aging. From the perspective of they are out in the local community, they are known in the local community, they can create those relationships. They're also closer to understanding maybe where the gaps in service Sure. delivery actually exist. And then we have also invested in creating resource developers that are working out in our regional offices. They partner with area agencies on aging. They partner with our state staff, again, to better understand where are those gaps in services happening. And they can build also those local relationships to try to drum up those small businesses. Right. They can maybe step into some of those gaps and niches that we have.
Well, you know, ALSA is nationally recognized for forward thinking. So what is it that we can look forward to from the administration within the next 5 years? What's on the horizon?
Well, we didn't talk a lot about our challenges, but what I would say is that some of the things that we need to face as we're looking forward is we've got this tremendous growth in population of older adults. We have growing prevalence of chronic conditions, growing prevalence of dementia, as an example. And we have workforce shortages, really significant direct care workforce shortages. And we need to find a way, again, to continue sustainable funding so that families can access long-term care when they need it. Moving forward, you have already talked to Ben Bechte. You know, we have a state law that has created an earned benefit for workers paying into WellCares so that they will be able to access a modest but important benefit of long-term services and supports beginning in 2026. So there's a lot of work being done to build that program out. We need to really look at enabling technology. We need to be able to really leverage what can be done virtually, what can be done through monitoring devices. How do we help caregivers continue to provide that critical service, the family caregivers, both family caregivers near and far, to support their loved ones, and workforce advancements as well? I think one of the positive things that came out of the pandemic is a recognition of the importance of home care workers, the importance of adult family homes, the importance of assisted living facilities. Those were things not really recognized as part of the healthcare delivery system, and they are part of the healthcare delivery system. So I think we will see that advancement of this workforce as being recognized as critical essential workers. I think we'll see more career ladders. I think we'll see more recognition of the workforce. And hopefully along with that will come wages, benefits, you know, working conditions that really support the workforce as well. So definitely different ways of paying for services, different ways of supporting family caregivers, use of enabling technology, those workforce advancements, but we also need to be thinking about adult protective services. Unfortunately, as the population ages, there are more incidents of abuse, neglect, and exploitation. So we need to really raise awareness around that and continue to build out a strong adult protective services program. We don't talk about APS as much as we should, but we're also a leader in the nation in terms of how our adult protective service program operates. And I know that we have a lot of goals around how do we stop financial exploitation,
right,
which leads people into poverty, right?
Right.
And also, how do we help individuals that are struggling to take care of themselves, the people that are maybe self-neglecting is what we mm-hmm. call that, right? It's a third of the intakes that come into adult protective services. And we need to find maybe more effective strategies than investigation about how do we work with individuals to take better care of themselves and really create kind of that community awareness that we're all interconnected.
Right.
And that we all need to take care of each other.
Washington helping Washington. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Bea. I'm looking at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Aging in Place is produced by Julie Cope, Tobiah Panchin, and Lee Schuler in conjunction with the Evergreen State College Graduate Studies Program. For additional information, citations, and show notes, please visit us on the web at capstone.panchin.net.